Chapter 10, 223 Baker Street. Holmes sits at the kitchen table, poring over the documents. The file marked Baker Street contains some 50 sheets of paper, typed on both sides, and with dozens of handwritten notes added in the margins. Sutro wrote like a half-blind man, or perhaps a spy, his writing almost illegible to anyone but himself. Deciphering the pile may take all night, but Holmes works with the same concentration that John has seen him exhibit before. He is utterly still. He will absorb and remember every detail, every last comma, and not for the first time, John finds himself questioning the nature of the man he found by the River Thames. Childlike on the one hand, almost superhuman on the other. He remembers the visit to the Reichenbach flour mill. That was a trail that led seemingly nowhere. They still have no idea who attacked Holmes and why. Another mystery, and one for another day. "You must be hungry," John says. Holmes ignores him, turns another page. "Well, all right, I'll see what I can rustle up." Lighting the range, John examines the assorted cans and packets in the cupboard. Missy is still at the hospital, and although he feels bad helping himself, he guesses that the money he paid her will more than cover a scratch supper for two. Eventually, he produces two plates of food, but Holmes has no appetite. His finger stabs down on one of the pages. "Now this is interesting," he exclaims. 2 weeks after Finn received his mysterious payment, the exact same amount was paid to Silas Wellborn." "Sorry, what?" With a sigh, John slides his plate away. "The next-door neighbour who was killed by a burglar, and almost immediately after his death, the house was purchased." "Who by?" "It doesn't say. The purchase was arranged through Sutro Legal Services, and the purchasers are only referred to as the clients. But as there have been strenuous efforts to buy Missy's house, it's reasonable enough to suppose that the purchasers were the same people who threatened her." Holmes's chair makes an alarming screech as he gets to his feet. "Where are you going?" "To visit the scene of the crime, of course." He snatches up a lantern from the table. John stares at him blankly. "Number 223, Holmes says impatiently. "Silas Wellborn and Finn Hudson both get paid the exact same amount on about the same date by a shadowy organization fronted by a crooked lawyer, and now they're both dead, as is the lawyer."
"Well, Finn was murdered.
Or at least not by those people, and Wellborn was killed by a thief breaking into his home." Holmes cocks an eyebrow. "Do you think these deaths and the attack on Missy were just remarkable coincidences?" John opens his mouth and closes it again. "Exactly. Come on, Watson." The wind has dropped and the wisps of fog creep like vines down the walls of the building as the two men emerge into the darkness. It is a little after 8 o'clock, and the street is deserted apart from an elderly woman carrying her shopping on the other pavement. She would look like an easy mark were it not for the fighting dog straining at the leash by her side. The window shutters on number 223 are closed, and the door securely locked. "The door is a little more solid than that of Mr. Sutro," Holmes murmurs. "No surprises there, although you would have thought the new owners would have moved in by now." "How can you tell they haven't? The dust on the windowsills, the dirty windows, the lack of lights." Even as Holmes speaks, he is taking a paperclip and two hatpins out of his pocket. The hatpins put John in mind of Susan Tarleton and the stables. He watches as Holmes unbends the paperclip and begins to work on the lock.
"How did you learn to do that?"
Watson asks.
"What? What you're doing now?"
"I have no idea." Perhaps John was right in his earlier assessment and Holmes really was a criminal. That would explain a lot of things. His prisoner's pale skin, his huge appetite, his having an enemy who might wish him dead. There is a click, and the door swings open. Holmes looks pleased with himself, as if he wasn't expecting it to be so easy. A gloomy hallway stands on the other side, although, unlike Missy's, it has a door leading off into a boot room opposite the stairs. There is a musty smell of stale air and damp, as if no one has been inside the place for a very long time. But it was only a few months ago that Wellborn was shot, and John is fairly sure that the house would have smelled exactly the same when he lived here. Holmes steps over the threshold
and after a glance up and down the street to check for any witnesses to the second break-in entering in one night, John follows, pulling the door shut behind him. He follows the dim glow of the lantern light up the staircase and through a second doorway straight ahead. "They were desperate enough to buy the place," Holmes says quietly, "but they didn't feel inclined to clear up." He raises the lantern to reveal a room in complete disarray. Chairs and tables have been overturned, the drawers of a tall oak dresser have been pulled out, their contents strewn all over the floor. Pictures have been torn off the walls and lamps smashed. The robbers have even ripped the covers off a few books, presumably in some desperate hunt for concealed money. "It was a crime scene," John says, "so maybe the police asked the new owners to leave it as it was while they investigated." "For 2 months?" "You know how long they take these days. Police are so short-staffed, it's a miracle they turn up at all." John pauses. "Maybe they plan to come back and look for any prints left by the burglars." "These weren't burglars, Watson. How can you be so sure?" "Look around you. If this was how Mr. Welburn lived, it would have been evident to even the most optimistic thief that there would be nothing here to steal. They'd have done better to break into Missy's." Holmes leans forward and snatches what looks like a pile of theatre tickets. But as he brings them into the light of the lantern, John sees that they are betting slips. "And there you have his life in a nutshell. He was a gambler. A losing gambler by the look of it." "Exactly. You think that's why he sold his house?" "Quite possibly, but the question still remains, the same question that I asked our esteemed landlady. Why? What is it they really wanted?" Holding up the lantern, Holmes crosses the room and enters the kitchen at the back of the house. John follows. The sight that greets them is not a pleasant one. The kitchen has been ransacked too. Plates have been smashed, drawers pulled out of their fittings. Even the fridge door hangs open. But worse than all this are the walls and the floor. A brown splatter clings to almost every surface. John has seen stains like this many times before, and recognizes the strange colour, or perhaps colourlessness, of dried blood. Is it surprising that it hasn't been wiped away? No, why would the police have bothered? Reluctantly, John joins Holmes on the other side of the kitchen. The lino is sticky beneath his feet, and the smell here is even worse than the rest of the house. "This is where he was shot," John says in a low voice. "You can still smell the blood." Holmes swings the lantern round. He has seen something. It's low down beneath one of the windows. "What is it?" John asks. He wonders if there is anything worse this house can reveal. Holmes is already crouching down, examining something, and John joins him. And now he sees what has taken hold of his friend's attention. Just above the skirting board beneath the window there is another bloodstain. But this is not a splash or splatter. It is a carefully drawn circle. This must have been left by the murderer. But even as he speaks the words, John knows it can't be true. What would have been the point? Holmes corrects him. "No, see where the line trembles a little here and here, and then at the end it trails off to the floor. Welburn wrote it as he died." "A message, then? A name beginning with O, or a zero?" Without warning, Holmes blows out the lantern and rises to his feet. In the sudden silence, John hears it too. The creak of the front door being pushed open, followed by quiet footsteps climbing the stairs. They are no longer alone. The new arrival has made no attempt to extinguish their own lantern. The glow gets stronger and stronger, throwing stark shadows against the sticky floor and discoloured walls. John takes out his revolver, and as quietly as he can, cocks the safety catch. Could it be that they were followed here? Or did one of the neighbours watch Holmes picking the lock and call for help? If it were a local constable, checking on the empty property, surely he would call out a warning. The very silence suggests danger, a trap closing. At the same time, John realises that it is not one set of footsteps coming up the stairs and towards the kitchen, but two. He can see the glow of the lamp getting closer and closer and asks himself, can he just stand here and wait for whoever arrives? Or should he fire first? Holmes is standing perfectly still. It is impossible to see his face in the shadows of the kitchen. The lamp reaches the door. John's finger
tightens on the trigger. Two men step into the room, and at that moment Holmes speaks.
It's all right, Watson.
Now it's the turn of the two men to react. Their lamp swings as they reach for their own weapons.
Police! One of them calls out. Step forward and identify yourselves.
Holmes does as he is asked. Almost languidly, he edges into the light being spilled by the new lantern.
My name is Sherlock Holmes, and this is Dr. Watson. He turns to John. Maybe it would help if you relit our own lamp?
Watson has lowered his revolver.
He finds a match and does as he has been asked. The two lamps are brought together, and now there is enough light in the room to reveal Detective Chief Inspector George Lestrade and his junior officer, Stanley Hopkins. It is Lestrade who is the first to make the connection.
I believe we've met, he says to John.
My name is Lestrade.
You were in the ambulance that took me to the hospital,
Holmes remarks.
That's right, although I thought you were unconscious.
So did I, John exclaims.
I must have been more awake than you believed, Holmes smiles. You had a son with anemia, which was diagnosed by Dr. Watson,
Lestrade says. He cannot help a certain hesitation. He had thought Watson to be a hospital porter.
I'm very grateful to you for your kindness, he continues hastily. That was a terrible night.
May I ask what you're doing here?
Hopkins asks.
He has no knowledge of these past encounters and wants to get straight to the point.
I was about to ask you the same,
Holmes replies. Hopkins isn't amused.
This is a police investigation. That much is obvious, but why would it be that brings you to an abandoned house in Baker Street unless perhaps you have an interest in a red circle?
What the hell? Hopkins begins.
That's exactly why we're here, Lestrade cuts in. Are you going to tell me that you're involved in some way with Dost Akbar and the plane that came down in Richmond?
I've never heard of Dost Akbar, and I must confess that I know nothing about the plane that came down either. But it strikes me that there is only one thing in this house that would interest two senior police officers, and it's what we just found.
Holmes takes the lantern back over to the skirting board.
A dying man leaves a message, and it would seem that, better late than never, the message has finally arrived.
He's right, sir.
Hopkins is shocked. But Lestrade knew he would find it there. He saw it when he visited the house at the time of Welburn's death, and although it had no significance at the time, he remembered it correctly.
Drawn on the skirting board of this shabby little house is the same symbol he saw on the £50 million painting in the offices of the businessman, a circle that, when it was freshly drawn, would have been quite literally blood red.
What do you know about this? He asks Holmes.
Only that it is tied into a mystery that we have been investigating.
What are you, Mr. Holmes, a private detective?
Holmes smiles briefly.
Not by choice, Chief Inspector, but it does seem to be what I've become.
Lestrade considers.
Can't talk here. Do you live nearby?
As it happens, we have rooms just two doors away.
John finds himself walking beside Lestrade as they return to Missy's house.
How is your son?
John asks.
He seems to have turned a corner, thank God.
Lestrade looks uncomfortable.
Just now, your friend called you Dr. Watson.
Forgive me, but I was under the impression
that I was a hospital porter.
I was, but before that, I used to be an army surgeon.
And your friend...
I saw him. He had a dreadful head wound. Didn't like to say it then, but I didn't think he'd make it through the night.
Nor did I.
But now he seems to be fully recovered. He must be a remarkable doctor.
John smiles.
I wish I could take the credit, but it's Holmes who is the remarkable patient. In fact, I find him inexplicable.
I hope you can help us, Chief Inspector. I know almost nothing about him except that he has a good heart. He can be extremely annoying, and almost despite myself, I'm growing very fond of him.
A few minutes later, the four men are sitting together in the kitchen. John has made tea for three of them. Hopkins has asked for coffee, and for a moment there is a silence as they examine each other over the steaming mugs. Lestrade glances at his deputy. Stanley Hopkins is not happy. A detective who comes from a long line of detectives His father famously helped close down the gang of violent bank robbers who called themselves the Red-Headed League. He still believes in the authority and even the efficacy of the police force and takes a dim view of this idea of mixing with civilians. But he'll come round. He always does, in his own time. For his own part, Lestrade is fascinated by Sherlock Holmes, and he remembers what he has been thinking these past few days. Hopkins is wrong to mistrust this strange man. Effie, his wife, was much closer to the truth when she let loose, as good as demanding his resignation. The London police are floundering, overwhelmed by the criminality that now holds the city in its grip. It's not just a case of failing technology and too few resources. Morale is rock bottom. The men and women who work with him need help from outside the system, someone they can believe is on their side. Could Holmes be what he's looking for? It's far too early to say, but as he sits in this warm and cozy kitchen with a cup of tea that's far too sweet, he feels a faint stirring of something that might just be hope. The game has changed. "Well," he begins, "it's very strange that the four of us should have come together in this way, but it's just possible that we're all after the same thing. What does this red circle mean? Silas Wellborn spent his last breath trying to bring it to our attention, and the same symbol drove a billionaire businessman to take his own life." "Both a warning and a threat," Holmes remarks. "Exactly." Lestrade considers. "Could it stand for some sort of society?" he suggests. In his time, he has come across snakes, cross daggers, skulls and blood drops, often tattooed on the skin of those he has arrested. "It's very possible," Holmes says. "Watson and I have been in pursuit of an organization that seems to be wealthy, well-informed and ruthless. The Red Circle? Perhaps we should think of it as that." "We may be looking for the same people," Lestrade says. "Although right now I don't see how they connect with a dead man living alone, a compulsive gambler with no family and few friends. But what I propose is that we exchange stories. We will tell you, in the very strictest confidence, what brought us here. You must then do the same. It may well be that we can assist each other. At the very least, we may provide each other with information which may prove to be of use. Do you agree?" "They should go first," Hopkins mutters. "I'm more than happy to do so," Holmes responds. "I will be as brief as I can, as I see you are tired, Mr. Hopkins. You had no sleep last night, I think." "You can't possibly know that, Mr. Holmes." "No, but I can surmise it. You shaved badly this morning. I could point to a patch of stubble on your chin. You also put on odd socks. Finally, you chose to drink coffee, not tea. However, let's get down to business." Quickly, Holmes takes the two police officers through the investigation as seen from his perspective, starting with the two attacks on Missy Hudson, the second infinitely more dangerous than the first. He describes the visit to the stables and the link between Finn and the corpulent lawyer, Cornelius Sutro. He explains how he and Watson broke into the offices of Sutro Legal Services, a detail that causes Hopkins to raise an eyebrow, and the file that they found there. This in turn led them to Silas Wellborn, who had, like Finn, received a mysterious payment from Sutro's client. "There was no burglary, of course," he concludes. "Whoever broke into 223 Baker Street tried to make it look that way, but it was a clumsy effort. What sort of burglar smashes plates or ransacks the fridge? I believe Mr. Wellborn was murdered because of his connection with Sutro and the people behind him." "What has Mr. Sutro got to say about all this?" Lestrade asks. "Mr. Sutro sleeps with the fishes," John remarks. "It's a line from a book he read a long time ago. He was surprised as he left the office, tipped into a pond and drowned." "And now it's your turn," Holmes continues, wasting no time on any regrets for Mr. Sutro. Lestrade nods. His story is shorter and less involved. A plane has crashed. It is possible that it was deliberately brought down. The aviation authorities are concealing rather than examining the evidence. The owner of the airline, Dost Akbar, was murdered, and a red circle was added to a valuable painting. "It is my belief that the red circle was a warning, and that it was enough to drive Mr. Akbar to take his own life. He was terrified." "You think terrorists attacked the aircraft?" John asks. "Not terrorists, not exactly. It's my belief that Mr. Akbar may have been blackmailed."
What kind of blackmailers take a plane out of the sky if you don't pay? Very dangerous ones, Holmes mutters. And you think these are the same people who are after Missy? John's eyes widen in horror. We must do something. We have to protect her. But Holmes is far away. It may well be that he is concerned for the safety of the woman who has become his landlady, but his extraordinary mind is already leaping much further ahead. Let us suppose that an organization exists which, for the sake of argument, we have called the Red Circle, he begins. It makes demands of a wealthy businessman, money, probably, and Akbar may have been only one of its victims. His PA mentioned that Akbar was meeting a number of other businessmen, Lestrade says. She said these meetings, summits, she called them, made him nervous, and that there was another one coming up. Somehow this organization has the ability and the cold-blooded desire to bring down a plane with 300 passengers, Holmes considers. All this makes sense, but it's not clear why this same organization should interest itself in two houses in Baker Street. Or possibly three, John remarks. We don't know if Missy's neighbours have been targeted. Who lives next door? Lestrade asks. It's a religious cult, a sort of brotherhood, John replies. I've seen some of them out in the garden. They call themselves the Ne Nimium Mendicants. What's that supposed to mean? Hopkins asks. Holmes gets to his feet. That bright, inquiring light is back in his eyes. I think perhaps it's time to find out.